Welcome to Her Leading Story, a podcast that will inspire you with stories from amazing female leaders and give you some ideas to help you design a life and a career that's perfect for you. It's totally doable, and the good news is that you'll have me and our community of leading women by your side every single step of the way. Let's get started. I'm your host, Julie Artis, and this is Her Leading Story. Welcome to Her Leading Story. I'm so excited to be here with this week's guest, Roseanne McTyre. I think the way that we're going to start this off, because of course I have her fabulous bio, I'm going to let her talk a little bit about what she does. But I'll start by saying that she and I have really connected over our nerdy scientific PhD connections. Roseanne is an epidemiologist who I often asked questions about during COVID-19. So I'm going to let her talk a little bit about what she does now, and then we'll go back and hear how she got there. Welcome, Roseanne.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Julie. It's so fun to be here with you. Well, if you want to start with now, I have to say I am happily doing work that resonates with my career, my scientific nerdiness, but also my personality. And that to me is a win-win. This month, it's going to be 14 years that I started my own company.
Wow.
The name of the company is Semaphore Scientific Strategies. And Semaphore is kind of a cousin word in Spanish, because it has an F rather than a PH, of the streetlights. Yellow, red, and green. And my son, who is a copywriter and a very creative, came up with that because I give advice. Say, go ahead, stop, cautious, not a good thing, with regards to strategies that end up resolving issues for companies or businesses. Recently, I do litigation support. And so I have evolved over the years, and we'll talk about that, in terms of what I like to do and what's my sweet spot. This is my sweet spot. And what I do now is I work with one law firm on the plaintiff side of litigation. And that law firm, what I do for them is find experts for litigation on the plaintiff side, which is always very challenging. A lot easier on the defense side, which I did for years. But when you bring it to the plaintiff side, where, you know, the funds, the resources are less, it's hard to get really world-class experts for litigation. But because I have so much experience, I can do this. And I'm very successful and valued. And I'm on a retainer with them, which is wonderful. So I work on really hot, wonderful issues that keep me energized.
Yeah, that's cool. And so connect the dots, not to the past yet, but with epidemiology. So in most cases, are you pulling on your network and even extended network or knowledge of science experts that can testify? Is that
95% of the time I am dealing with scientific experts, a lot of epidemiologists, but biostatisticians, toxicologists, people who can weigh in on different sides of issues. But it really does relate to anything. So every now and then I get asked to find an expert, let's say on a gas pipe in New Mexico, you know, to talk about the health effects of maintenance and building that. So it all has to do with health, and it all has to do with medicine. And right now it's very focused, but I've done the whole gamut. And in addition, people call me because I have almost 40 years of experience. So people call me, and then I will do other things as well. Mm-hmm. Additionally, but I'm not looking for it anymore. So,
Right. Yeah, that's, I mean, it's such an interesting position that you found yourself in. And I was always fascinated as we got to know each other about how you ended up there. And I know pieces, but not the whole story. So I'm so excited to interview you about the different twists and turns your career has taken over the years. So why don't we go back and just go ahead and get started? Because I'm so curious how you ended up here. I mean, I don't know, where do we start? In college or like what?
Well, we can start, you know, as in any profession, you can go in a straight line from your education up to what usually people do. And that's like maybe 95% of people. And I, because I've always been a very outside of the box thinker and need stimulation and excitement and new things, I went zigzag, you know, I went zigzagging instead of straight up. So I started going to college. I went to Swarthmore College, and an interesting tidbit that your listeners would enjoy. I've always loved art and I wanted to major in studio arts. I've painted, I've drawn since I was little. I've always been fascinated by it. And I went to college and they had a great studio arts program. And of course, my parents said, there is no way we're paying this kind of money for you to major in studio art and be a starving artist. So you better pick something else.
Wow.
So I looked around and, you know, with creativity and artistic also comes the other side of the brain. And at Swarthmore, it was great because it's very small and you could explore so many different things to major in. You had 2 years to declare your major. So I sat in on a lot of classes and I was captivated by biology and cell biology, and specifically cell biology. It was just so interesting. And I loved the experiments and I loved learning about, you know, genetics. It was all fascinating. So I majored in cell biology. And then, many will relate to this, I met my ex-husband in college, and he was an engineer. And I really wanted to go to medical school. That's where I thought my future was. But then I started looking into it, and I saw my sister who went to medical school, and just very long hours, very dedicated, you know, especially then. And I'm going like, this is not going to work. This is not going to work. And so again, I applied to medical schools. I became naturalized because I'm from Argentina. And at 18, I became naturalized so I could apply to medical schools. I got into 5 and then decided I'm not doing this. But in the process, I sat in on an epidemiology lecture. It made a lot of sense to me from the standpoint of prevention and health. And I really like critically reviewing studies and tearing them apart. And this is what Swarthmore teaches you to do, to critically think and, you know, challenge things. And I said, you know, this is a great thing. So we got married very early and then we took turns going to school. And I ended up going to Yale School of Medicine, Department of Epidemiology and Public Health, in the very exclusive, it was an amazing master's degree in infectious disease epidemiology and specifically viruses. And that went with my cell biology interest. And I went through that, some of the biggest names. It was amazing. It was an amazing experience. But when I finished, and that was in 1976, there was nothing to work on. All, you know, smallpox had been eradicated. There was just, I'm going like, what am I going to do? You
know? It's really ironic now, right? After the pandemic that we've been through.
On the heels of HIV, Ebola, all these, it would have been very interesting for me to remain in that. But, you know, the other thing that I noticed is I love the challenge. I loved the cellular stuff, but you're closed up in a lab and it's a very solitary kind of work. And I felt that. I felt like, oh my God, this is not really.
You're super extroverted.
I'm an extreme extrovert and I'm going like, this doesn't feel great. So I didn't know what to do. And then my ex-husband took a turn. So then while we were living here in Washington, D.C., I took internship that's called the COSTEP, Commissioned Officer Student Training Program at NIH. And I worked in the Institute of Child Health and Human Development with really amazing people who are doing landmark studies in child health. And I saw all these people, all these, we call them PIs, principal investigators. And my job with a master's degree from Yale was really to go to the National Library of Medicine with rolls of dimes and get books out of the reference section, because we didn't have, this was 70s, right?
Yeah.
And sit all day copying articles for them or for me to analyze and to sit down and do. I just didn't do that and didn't like it. And I wanted to be like them, you know?
Yeah.
And I wanted to be my own boss. And so I decided to get my PhD in chronic disease epidemiology, which seemed a lot more marketable right then and there. At that stage, it was when all those big epidemiology studies, the Framingham study, the Mr. Fit study, all those studies that were being done, longitudinal studies to look at heart disease and, you know, the risk factors for heart disease were going on. And that was pretty cool. So I really liked doing that. And in the meantime, when my ex-husband went to Stanford for a year, I worked at the Public Health Service Hospital in San Francisco in a preventive medicine clinic. And that kind of changed my life. I was moving around all day. I wasn't doing the busy work that I don't like. I was talking to patients. I was helping them change their behavior when they had high blood pressure or high cholesterol with lifestyle modifications. Mm-hmm. And we were studying this. It was really fascinating. And I knew that I wanted to be at the interface of the patient or the person, not really doing what is typical for epidemiologists is either research, grant working in the government, right? Yeah. At FDA or NIH. And I'd done that. That was not me. So I went that way and got out of the commissioned officer, you know, area, and I went private and I started working. So when I started Hopkins, I was pregnant with my first son, who's 43 right now. And that was, I started in January. He was born in July. So I would go with him to class, you know, and that's when I started my PhD program. Soon realized that I was going to have a nervous breakdown with everything that was going on, being married in the house. So I went part-time. And it took me 8 years to finish my PhD. And I ended up pregnant with my daughter, who's 35 now. So I studied and I didn't work very much. I worked a little bit just to, you know, do my research. Hopkins requires original data gathering for a PhD. So I had to do that. I had to do a whole dissertation. It took a long time, but it was hands-on and it was practical and it was applicable. And that's where my love of communication and strategy and advice comes from.
Yeah. And a deep knowledge of methods.
Yes.
And how to set up studies, how to critique them in a deeper way, what's possible and what's not. I mean, there's so much that you learn from that process. What was your dissertation on?
My dissertation. So I was working in DC while I was studying for a company called General Health. And General Health is a company that no longer exists that basically produced health risk appraisal questionnaires, instruments. It was a whole algorithm. And I worked with the person who did the algorithm to provide the data from all these longitudinal studies that would drive the thing for cardiovascular disease, longevity, and cancer. And so we sold this to companies. So I took that and I applied it. I designed the whole thing. I gave it to employees of the electrical company here. It's called PEPCO, Potomac Electric Power Company. And I administered this thing to all of them. I analyzed all the data. I coded it. I analyzed it. I looked at it. The goal of these in industry was to find out problems. You know, it's the healthy worker effect. You're only as good as the health of your employees. Yeah. So to do health promotion programs and intervene early. And I did find a higher rate of breast cancer among women who worked at PEPCO and also cigarette smoking. It was the 70s. And as a result of my study, they put in programs to address early screening for women and smoking prevention programs too. So it had some application, which was great.
Well, which is what I love about epidemiology in general, yeah. right? Is how applied it is as a field, even though there is, of course, an academic side and a, you know, sort of a public health type side. So you got your PhD.
So my PhD was not in straight epidemiology because Hopkins is so big, has such a big department that they allow you to do other things. Yeah. So mine was in epidemiology and behavioral health. So it was straddling those two because it was more front-facing, you know, that I was mm-hmm. interested in doing. And so that's what I got my PhD.
Like contact with patients and...
Yeah, or companies or CEOs. And so after my daughter was born, I had three kids at home and all I wanted to do was go do something and work. And so I started working for a survey research firm near me, very part-time. And one day I was in the elevator and I met this woman who changed my life. And she's a pharmacologist. And we got talking and she said, you know, you're an epidemiologist. This company that I do part-time work for is looking for an epidemiologist to work by the hour. You can work anywhere to review papers on fetal alcohol syndrome and alcohol for a beverage. You know, it was a beer manufacturer. Wow. And do you want to do that? And I said, oh my God, this is great. They paid me $40 an hour.
$40 an hour? And in the 80s, right?
1988.
Wow.
I'm going like, this is great. And because I'm a morning person, I'm very active. I'd get up at 5 o'clock, work for 4 hours, make all this money, and then have a whole day with my kids. It was amazing. So I worked for that firm for 18 years. It's called the Wine
Group. Wow.
And I worked for them for 18 years and I started by the hour. Then as the kids got older, I went part-time, one day, 2 days, 3 days. I ended up being the vice president of epidemiology and biostatistics for the firm, which I did for a couple of years until it became difficult because, you know, when you work for consulting firms on the defense, on the industry side, there's a lot of money, but the rates are very high. And to make budgets so that I could keep people busy, that I could make, you know, keep me busy and sell work, it became challenging. I didn't like that. I didn't like that because it was difficult.
So in that role as vice president, you were also responsible for drumming up business. And
yes.
That was the hard part. And the part that even you as an extrovert felt like, yeah, this isn't really aligned with what I want to be spending my time doing.
That's right. And not only that, but it was very hard. The budgets were astronomical for things that I realize now that I do it on my own, could be done at a quarter of the cost. So what happened is that the woman who I met in the elevator, she went on her own. She started her own company in medical device regulatory work. And she hired me to be the vice president of epidemiology and biostatistics at this company called Becker and Associates. Karen Becker is her name. And I worked there for 5 years. That was the best ever job that I had. It was a very boutique firm. We worked on very high risk medical devices that were having problems getting through the FDA approval process. And so I, as an epidemiologist, I wouldn't do the work, but I would get the experts that were needed to either look at data, generate data, repackage data, talk about this with the FDA. I did a medical device dispute resolution panels. It was so fun. I love that. Opened another area, which was medical devices, which are very interesting. And I'm still very interested in that area. I work on that for my client every now and then when there's medical devices. So that was a great job. And then after 5 years, things changed. And an old client of mine, when I was at the Weinberg Group, the other place, called me and they needed an epidemiologist for waste management. I did a lot of environmental work when I was consulting. They needed an epidemiologist to work on a landfill in Fresno, California, where migrant workers were living and working. And there were allegations of birth defects as of exposure to alleged contaminants in the air from the hazardous waste disposal. So I did that for like 3 years. That was really fun. I got to go there. I got to talk to them. I got to talk about risk and how do you, you know, get from here to there. I went to all kinds of town hall meetings. I love that. So that I did for a while. And then I stayed in with my own firm. I've never done anything else.
So you're no longer working with that woman in her firm.
Yeah.
And was it that case, that old client that who pulled you into this? Is that why you started your own business?
Yeah, they made an offer I couldn't refuse. And it's hard to find the combination of epidemiologists who can communicate.
Yes.
Who likes,
to communicate?
Because the problem is, here's the problem. Very technical information. You have to do it at eighth grade level language. And I can do that. I've learned to do that. And so I'm very valuable to people who need to interpret high technical science to lay audiences. Mm-hmm. And so that worked. And yeah. And so I started my own company to be able to do that. And the rest is history. Here I am, semi-retired, but loving what I do. So
I love that. So is that when you started your own company, is when you started working fewer hours, or at the beginning you were still working full time and then more recently you've sort of dialed back the hours?
Well, what happened was that when I worked for waste management, I worked a lot. I had to travel a lot. I had to prepare. I had to talk on the phone. I worked a lot. And then what happened is after like 3 years, people know each other in this area, and I've been around. I do get known because I'm a communicator, you know. Mm-hmm. So another colleague of mine who had never worked for, she called me and wanted me to join her firm and leave my company. And I said, no, this is what I've always wanted to do, be in a leadership position. I don't like people telling me what to do. And, you know, I call my own shots. But she said, I have a lawyer who is looking for somebody like you to bring world-class experts in from the defense side to the plaintiff. And are you interested? And again, that changed my life because I've never left them. This was like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And I'm still working with the original ones, but more with others. With the current firm, I've been 8 years. Wow. And now I do more stuff for them with another part of the firm. So yeah, it gave me the opportunity to start my own company and get into litigation support on the public health side, which always has been my passion. So yeah. It's so rewarding to help people who are injured and people who are underrepresented with good science and good experts. Yeah. There's a lot of, you know, plaintiffs firms that are not great, but this firm that I work for is amazing. So,
wow.
Yeah, I'm very lucky and they value my work and I love them. We're like a family now and it's very easy for me.
Yeah.
I don't work very much.
Yeah.
And I
get I'm really struck by hearing this story chronologically. I'm really struck by two things. One is that you were really tuned into yourself about what you liked and what you didn't. And there were several things where you thought, oh, maybe I'll go this way. Oh, but I had an experience with that. I did an internship. I did a job. I did whatever. And then you realized, oh, okay, maybe it's not exactly this, but it's related. And then when you were in with patients, you knew immediately, oh, this is much more for me than pulling journal articles and reading them in a cubicle.
Yeah.
For somebody else, right?
Right. So that was not fun.
And so it seems to me, and then when you talk about the zigging and the zagging, what I love about that is that you really, from a young age, trusted yourself in what you knew, right? That you knew.
I think I have always had a very good intuition about what's good for me and what resonates. And once the obstacles were removed, and I'll tell you, this one is interesting because I bet more than one woman is exposed to this. So my ex-husband had no relationship to epidemiology or what a career would mean or what you need to do to be your own boss and to call your shots and to get the work that you want to do and be in your niche. And when my son was born and he had finished his master's, and that's all he has is a master's, he's very successful in his field. You don't need a PhD. He's an expert witness in construction management. And I try to explain, you know, and he didn't get it. So one time, I will never forget these words. He said, "Why don't you get a job and help the family? You really don't have to do this."
The PhD.
Yeah. Yeah. And I said, no, mm-hmm. no. And I knew something inside of me said, you need to keep on going. I have this grit about me. Like you know, I don't quit. So I found the way and I got it done. And I am not sorry. I never knew I was going to be divorced. I'd need to support myself to be financially stable, to have my own life, mm-hmm. to be independent. And look at that.
Right. And so then when you did get divorced, you had this education, you had this experience, and it would have been different. Your life would have been different had you.
Different. But also, I think the other thing that is different for me is like I'm very open-minded and creative and out of the box because I see the opportunities and I go for it and take the risk, you know, to do things like starting my own business was risky, but I already had a client, you know, so I knew that I would be fine at least for a few years, you know, and then you keep on marketing and getting known and getting more work. Having your own business is not an easy thing to do if you're relying on being financially solvent with that, because there's a lot of marketing. There's a lot of work you have to do to get work. And that's why I went for the retainer, because the retainer has always been awesome.
Right. At least you know that you're getting that and everything else is gravy in a sense. Yeah.
Right. But you have to have value. You have to add value. I wouldn't have had the same value on the defense side because there's many people like me, but I do have it on the plaintiff side.
Yeah. I wonder, the other thing that I was thinking about, in addition to your grit and your knowing and being drawn to things that are right for you, is also related to this marketing thing, which is the idea that a lot of the opportunities that you had that had a big impact on your career were because you had conversations with people.
Absolutely. That network is invaluable. Yeah. Rolodex. Yeah. I mean, even to this day, you know, I need an expert and I think of, I met 20 years ago and I can find them, you know. One tip, never, if you have a Mac, never delete your emails. I have 58,000 emails in my Mac. And when I have to find something, I find it. It's there, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know if you can do it in anything other than Apple, but they told me at the Apple store, they said, you don't need to delete them. It's not going to do anything to your, you know, so I can always, that network is very important. And over the years, as you accrue contacts, and it's very important to keep it up. And also if you're a connector like I am, you keep in touch. So I've made a lot of friends along the way and colleagues that I still work. So my business model has been, you know, I work on my own because I don't want to have employees. I don't have to want to worry, but I have a whole bunch of people around me that I can call if I, one, can't take something or it's too much or I need help. And I can either have my client pay them directly or I can pay them, or I just give them work and get a percentage.
Yeah.
I do that too, like a 10% commission for giving them work. Yeah. So, you know, you learn how to be an entrepreneur and make money out of your contacts and your, you know, connections. Yeah. So, yeah.
So, you know what I love? So you started this in your 50s then, right?
Later, 60.
See?
I'm 71.
So this is my, like, it's never too late.
No, in fact, age is an advantage for me. Many people, as they age, they get less marketable.
Yeah.
For me, as long as my brain works and I have my computer and my hands and my voice, and I could work forever because it's me that they pick. It's my brain, you know, my Rolodex, my contacts, and my ability to connect with people. So now when I get experts, you know, I can talk their language and they don't answer the phone if it's a lawyer. They'll answer my phone. I'll call Dr. McTire and they answer the phone and I can talk to them intelligently about what it is that I'm looking for. So that value is enduring.
Yeah.
Enduring.
That's so incredible. I love that angle to this whole trajectory because I work with midlife women who are thinking about pivoting to a new career. They're like, I'm 45. Is it too late? I'm like, no.
You're right. Well, you know, of course, it depends on what career you're in, you know?
Well, of course.
Who knows? But if it's something that values education, knowledge, network, you know, technical expertise, communication. And also, like I've told my kids, it's not your degree, it's your skills. It's what you can do. So it's like, I, for example, now I'm interpreting in English, Spanish. There's many things I can do with my strengths. Mm-hmm. And I can mentor. I love to mentor people. I don't like to teach big classes. I've tried that and I don't like it. Mm-hmm. But I do like one-to-one mentoring of people, of students. Swarthmore sends me a lot of budding scientists. Mm-hmm. And I love that. I love that. But I think it's never too late. You just have to identify your skills and promote that aside from your technical knowledge, because more and more, it's hard to fit in some careers into, they're obsolete, but you could still do other things with your skills and your assets and your strengths that you have accrued over the course of, you know, your regular career. Yeah. And those are the people who succeed, the ones who can pivot.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting too, because I think you sit at this really unique spot of somebody who has deep technical skills, fantastic communication skills, and a network that's been built in over 20 plus years. Yeah. And so I can see how that translates in the marketplace, so to speak, for a lot of value. Right. Yeah. And so, you know, it's fascinating. And didn't you just get certified?
Well, during COVID, I took an online course with the University of Massachusetts at Amherst to be a certified interpreter. I don't like writing. I like talking. So the interpreting part. And I got certified and I'm starting next week on Wednesday to interpret for a cardiologist at a free clinic for people who don't have insurance and don't speak English. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be in the room with him interpreting for all these people who have all kinds of problems.
Yeah.
And that is very rewarding to me. So I'm at the stage of giving back and trying to help others and give back a little. I've been so fortunate that I want to do that. So,
and I mean, I think of that as like building a legacy, right? It's not just your career, but it's like now you're at this point where you're not working as many hours, your living expenses are settled, you have grandkids that you like to visit,
right?
But you can take on these passion projects that you really care deeply about.
Yes.
And so that's one of them. The mentoring is another.
Yes, I love to mentor young budding scientists and, you know, kind of tell them, you know, that it isn't a straight line unless you want it to be. You can go ever which way and you can apply the skills and the knowledge to other areas and you can continue to learn. I love learning. So for me, it was really fun to do that. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Good for the brain, never mind, you know. Interpreting is amazing for cognitive function.
Oh, I bet. I bet. Yeah. And you were already fluent, right? Because you had grown
up. It's my first language.
Yeah. Okay. So I know you've talked a little bit about the challenges with work and family and going back to school and family, but especially in a field like science and getting your PhD in the 70s and 80s. Could you reflect a little bit on what it was like to be a woman at that time, trying to figure out what you wanted to do?
You know, fortunately, I was at the time, there were a lot of women going into science. So it wasn't a male-dominated field. Uh-huh. It wasn't medicine. It was epidemiology. And there were a lot of women. And, you know, reflecting back, I'm very fortunate that I never, ever experienced discrimination, either in pay or in value or in anything because I was a woman.
Never.
Yeah. The challenges I felt were from my ex-husband and, you know, my parents, which I'm grateful now because I really love what I do. And now I'm doing art too. So they were right. They were right. And they struggled to fund. We were three sisters, three women, and they put everything they had to make sure we had the best educations possible. And we're all very successful. So that's being very grateful to them. And expertise and smarts and all of that were valued.
You were able to navigate things. It's also like the way I think about it in terms of you being inside an organization or corporate America, so to speak. You already had your PhD. You already had a lot of experience.
Right.
You had, I mean, it is true that having a PhD kind of confers a lot of authority, right? In situations where people might assume that because you're a woman, you're the secretary or you're the assistant or whatever.
The challenges I had was working with women bosses. That would be the only challenge that I can think of where I would disagree with what their approach was, but I had to do what they wanted me to do because they were the boss.
Yeah.
That's when I said, you know, I got to be my own CEO. I don't agree. And then because I had an expert, like when I worked in medical device consulting, it was the woman CEO, but with her it was different because I had my own area of expertise. So she respected me and my opinion, you know, it wasn't like she knew more than I did in that area. And, but it was hard. Working for private industry is challenging. It's very demanding. There's a lot of pressure to perform. If you don't perform, you're out. You know, it's very different than working for the government or perhaps in education. In this area of high stakes for companies and high rewards, very cutthroat, very hard, very pressured to perform. And not only with the work, but bringing money and get clients and keep people busy. And there was a lot of pressure in that regard. But, you know, for me, like you said, in the last almost 15 years, I've worked on my own. So that has not been an issue.
Wow.
Yeah.
The other question that I like to ask people, and this will be interesting to hear from you, which is if you had any advice to give yourself at like 18 or 22, what would you tell that younger part of yourself?
Follow your heart because you knew where you were going. Always follow your heart. Like, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't have any regrets. I wouldn't have done any differently. I think that life circumstances taught me to go one way or another. And then I followed what my intuition said was right. And I figured out how to do it. It wasn't easy. With my ex-husband, I applied without him knowing and I got in. I mean, this is what I did. Yeah. And then there was no choice.
I'm going.
I'm going. So, you know, I figured it out. I mean,
Yeah.
In the area of work and career, I don't have any regrets.
Yeah.
Personally, in my area of my personal choices and my personal life and emotional life and all of that, I would have advice for myself.
Yeah.
That I would have given my 22-year-old self.
Yeah. Yeah. But not in terms of career.
No.
Incredible.
That I excelled.
You excelled according to your definition of success, not anybody else.
Yes. No, nobody else. Nobody else, just me. Of course, I made my parents very happy while they were alive that I did all these things. I got my PhD, you know. But it's been a very rewarding career for me.
That's
makes
awesome.
Me very happy.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Great. Well, this has been so great to hear from soup to nuts. Rope hands, zigzaggy career story. And I know this is going to be so useful for people that are thinking about entrepreneurship, that are going to be thinking about what their real value is, what their skills are. I love that you talked about that. And I am thrilled that you made the time to be on Her Leading Story. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much. This has been fun.
And that's a wrap on this episode of Her Leading Story. If you love this episode, please help me reach more women by leaving a review wherever you're listening. Thank you so much for being here, and I'll see you next week.